From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. More and more now, single women outnumber married women in America. Some don't marry or were married. Many marry later. In 1960, 60% of American women were married by 29, many long before. Now that's only 20%. That means more years of more freedom, more career building, more single living. It's putting pressure on societal structures long designed for married couples. It is changing power dynamics and the experience of life for millions of Americans. This hour On Point, the era of the single woman. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you a single woman? By choice, by circumstance, is society keeping up with your presence, your numbers? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Rebecca Traister, writer-at-large for New York Magazine, contributing editor at Elle, author of Big Girls Don't Cry. Her new book is All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women, and the Rise of an Independent Nation. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Rebecca Traister in New York, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
This is an incredible book. I didn't know what to expect, but there's so much depth and so many facets to this. I wish you'd just start in by giving us the numbers, driving home what is happening demographically. It's a lot more than demographics, as you make clear, but what's going on?
Well, you know, there's the number that you cited that is so startling to me that, you know, 20% of Americans 18 to 29 are wed right now, 20% mm-hmm. of Americans 18 to 29. And that number compares to 60% in 1960. The other startling thing is that the median age of first marriage for women, as long as they've been keeping track of this, which began in the 1890 census, the median age for first marriage for women only fluctuated between 20 and 22 between 1890 and 1980. So 90 years, and presumably it wasn't a lot higher than that before 1890 when they started keeping track of it, right? Mm-hmm. So that is, you know, that it was the range. That was the marker of the beginning of adult life for women between the ages of 20 and 22 was the median moment at which they got married. Now, by 1990, there had been what is a huge jump compared to that only two-year age range. It was above 23 by 1990. It is today above 27 and much higher than that in cities, above 30 in many cities. It's the median age for first marriage. So if you look at that pattern, which remained relatively flat for about a century and probably longer than that, there has now been a massive jump. And that jump is so tremendous in part because it really means years lived outside of, whether those are 5 years or 10 years or 20 years or a lifetime outside of the institution, marriage, which for so many generations and really for all of our history, both defined and contained women and their adult lives.
This isn't just years without a ring on it, as what Beyonce had it. This is experience. This is different kinds of companionship, of socializing, of career building, of political presence. You look at these years and the fact of this population as a very significant cultural change.
Of course, it's the building of adulthood for women outside of marriage, which is revolutionary. It is. It's certainly the establishment of economic stability, of career. In many cases, it's having children outside of marriage. Half of first-time births to women under 30 at this point are to unmarried women. So in many cases, it's the formation of families outside of marriage, of having children. It is the development of friendships and social structures. It's women making their homes in the world, in their cities or their suburbs or their mm-hmm. rural homes. In many cases, you know, single women now buy more houses than single men. It is the development of full, robust adult life for women as independent entities, and that is a norm and not an aberration. Because, of course, there have always been women who lived outside of marriage. Mm-hmm. They've been many fewer in number. And also, there has been social stigma. There has been, you know, what they've been aberrations to mm-hmm. what has been the normal path of female adulthood, which has been kicked off by and then often defined by marriage to a man. And that is not the way that American women or men are living anymore. And it is it changes everything about how the country and its social policies and its and marriages themselves work.
And just the experience of life. You got this wonderful passage early in the book where you talk about how you began writing this, 17 years, you say, after you went to college, just before mm-hmm. getting married, in your case, at age 35. And you write that marriage did not feel like an ending for you, but it also didn't feel like a beginning. I wonder if you could read about, in this extended single person, single woman life, all some of the experience that you stacked up there.
Sure. By the time I walked down the aisle, or rather into a judge's chambers, I had lived 14 independent years, early adult years that my mother had spent married. I had made friends and fallen out with friends. I had moved in and out of apartments. I'd been hired, fired, promoted, and quit. I had had roommates I liked and roommates I didn't like, and I had lived on my own. I'd been on several forms of birth control and navigated a few serious medical questions. I had paid my bills, and I had failed to pay my bills. I'd fallen in love and fallen out of love and spent 5 consecutive years with nary a fling. I'd learned my way around new neighborhoods. I'd felt scared and felt completely at home. I'd been heartbroken, afraid, jubilant, and bored. I was a grown-up, a reasonably complicated person. I had become that person not in the company of any one man, but alongside my friends, my family, my city, my work, and simply by myself. I was not alone.
Rebecca Tracer, definitely not alone. A huge cohort of American women now having many, many more years of that single life. She writes about it in her new book, All the Single Ladies. Right in the front of the book, you take us all the way back to 1896, and you've got this little front piece where you bring back Nellie Bly, the famous 19th century journalist, asking Susan B. Anthony, of course, the great fighter for women's rights. And Nellie Bly says, "What do you think the new woman will be?" Susan B. Anthony says, "She'll be free." Is this it? Single status? Is that the freedom?
Well, it's interesting because because Susan B. Anthony herself, when I started this book, I intended it to be an examination of contemporary women living singly in unprecedented numbers. And the numbers are unprecedented, in large part because of some of the social progress that has been made, certainly at the end of the 20th century and going back a couple centuries, that have allowed women to have more economically, sexually, socially liberated lives that permit women to live outside of marriage mm-hmm. in ways that haven't always been practically possible in the past. But what I did not know, I really sort of thought, oh, this is this contemporary event, and it doesn't have historical precedent. And what I discovered is that, in fact, there's tremendous historical precedent, and especially in the 19th century when a lot of men moved west as part of westward exploration, and a lot of men died in the Civil War, and a lot of women were left single on the East Coast, especially middle-class white women. And this is, we probably have heard of Boston marriages in mm-hmm. which women, unmarried women, cohabited and sort of formed partnerships throughout life. And what I didn't realize is how much agitation there was. There were arguments in the press about the limitations that marriage was putting on women then and how the path to freedom might be by evading marriage. And Susan B. Anthony herself, in an 1877 speech, prophesied that in the move toward greater gender equality, we would need to live through an epoch of single women in which women stopped marrying. So I do believe we are living through that epoch. I really do. I got chills the first time I read the Susan B. Anthony speech, saying this is what's going to need to happen if we actually want equality between the sexes. Even if we change the laws, we have to change our custom of living together and the power dynamics of marriage. And we have to do that by women will start abstaining from marriage and men and women will live more equally and independently in the world. And I thought, oh my God, this is what's happening. Now, the question of, are we free? We are freer than we have been before. We also live in a nation that does not support this configuration through its social and economic policies. So you have all these numbers of newly independent women, and yet there aren't a lot of social or civic or political structures that are supporting their independence in the ways that the old pattern of how we lived, which was in paired hetero married units.
What's missing
were supported
for single
by
women,
the government.
What's missing?
Oh, all kinds of social supports. I mean, paid leave, right? If you're living in a nation in which women are having children outside of marriage, and even within marriage, of course, a lot of these things benefit married and single women. You know, it is economically unfeasible for a woman who has a child on her own, and especially we also don't have subsidized daycare, to have a child and simply go back to work. But of course, without mandated paid leave, that's what it is. Higher minimum wages, you know. 42% of families headed by single mothers live below the poverty line. We have half of minimum wage workers are single women, many of them single mothers. All of these kinds of things that are actually, interestingly, now at the center of the Democratic debate within the primary are issues that profoundly make an impact on women's ability to live independently in the world. And it's even things like how school days are structured, right? The idea that kids get let out of school at 3 o'clock and have these vastly long summer vacations. The way that our country is organized is around a principle that there are two kinds of Americans. One who does the earning and is in the public sphere and has the public power and the political power, and whose domestic life is enabled by another kind of American who does often the unpaid or low paid work of caring for children, the cooking, the cleaning, and the domestic labor. But that is not how we live anymore. We do not live in partnered units like that in which it's organized that way, and we need to revise our policies to accommodate that.
Rebecca Traister, please stand by. It is so great to have you. This is one terrific book. We're going to dive right on in. Beyonce behind us. The new book is All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women, and the Rise of an Independent Nation. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's exploding number of single women, their lives, their impact in the workplace and society, their power. My guest is Rebecca Traister, writer-at-large for New York Magazine. Her new book is All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women, and the Rise of an Independent Nation. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can join us today. Do you see this wave around you? Is this you, single, female? Are these American women, are you single by choice, by circumstance, because it's okay now? And is being a single woman now enviable? Is it empowered? Does it mean liberation to you or something else? People talk about it in all kinds of ways. This was Whoopi Goldberg a year or two ago talking with Oprah Winfrey, explaining why she prefers to be single.
I don't mind being on my own. If I want company, I can find company. Whatever else I need, it's there. But I'm okay on my path. I like my path. I like not having to explain myself constantly. And you have to, you have to give and take in a relationship. And, I don't really got much to give these days.
Not everybody's on board. Here was Mitt Romney, commencement speech at Southern Virginia University 2013. He encouraged graduates not to wait too long to get married.
Combining your life with another person, particularly someone, when a man and a woman are as different as we are, this combination is extraordinarily challenging and enormously rewarding. Some people could marry but choose to take more time, they say, for themselves. Others plan to wait until they're well into their 30s or 40s before they think about getting married. They're going to miss so much of living, I'm afraid.
Rebecca Traister joins us. There's Mitt Romney with the get into it and get going, but people are just going the other way. You know, sometimes you call this a new adulthood for women, a free adulthood. At other times you call it something like an extended adolescence, since so much of this is not all in youth. You're including in some of these numbers women who have lost spouses or who have divorced. How do you characterize this long period?
Well, lots of people have characterized it as an extended extended adolescence. And I actually push back at that a little bit in the book. I understand why that's interesting from a social science perspective, that there is now a sort of new stage, perhaps especially new for women who have historically married so young and really marked their adulthood by beginning marriages and now are not doing that in anywhere near the same numbers. But I actually really do push back in the book about at the notion that this is an inherently immature stage, because it seems to suggest that still to reinforce the old model, which is that adulthood began with marriage. But in fact, adulthood begins whether or not you're married. And one of the points that I work hard to make in the book is that single life is real life. It's not a practice round. It's not a dress rehearsal. It's not, you know, extra teenage years, you know, before you get to the real stuff of life, which we still somehow presume to be marriage and children. Single life in many ways is, and for many people, is a far more mature period in which there's not necessarily anybody to split a load with you, right? So you, many single women are doing their own earning, their own cleaning, their own home repairs, in many cases, their own child rearing, and have responsibilities that are not halved. You know, they may be, you know, they have friendships, they have incredible, many of them have incredible networks of support. But I know in my own experience, my life as a single person in which I was fixing my own bookcases in the middle of the night and responsible for if the light bulb blew and responsible for paying the cable bill and responsible, you know, all of that. I actually feel like my married years in some ways are the less mature time because I have somebody to help me out with all those things. And so I really object to the notion. And it also comes – you could hear it a little bit in Mitt Romney's rhetoric. They choose to live for themselves first. We still are very nervous in this country, especially about women who are – we still presume that their value is in their selflessness and their service to husbands, to children, to community, to God, whatever. We are still very nervous in this country about the notion that women have selves that might come first. And single life seems to – and the popular depictions of single life seem to bring out a lot of that anxiety in us. And the idea that women might be living for themselves in any way, I think, still makes a lot of people very uncomfortable and still draws a lot of criticism. And you could hear the shadows of that in what Mitt Romney was saying.
The heart of these numbers, which have grown so dramatically of single women, is that people are just getting married later. And I assume guys are getting married later as well. That's not the subject of your book here, but this is more significant, as you portray it, for women than for men.
Right. Well, that's absolutely true. And I actually think there should be many books written about – and I do in the book write a bit about the kind of impact this has on men's lives. For example, if women are newly participating in public and economic spheres and developing their own skills in realms that used to be coded male, then men living on their own are entering – are taking on responsibilities that used to be coded female, so that if you have men living independently for their whole lives or into their 20s, 30s, 40s, they are learning to cook and do their own laundry, which also changes the terms if they do enter hetero marriages later. You have both people coming with a set of skills that used to be divided by gender and now maybe more shared and more equally distributed within the marriage. That's the ideal scenario. But the book does focus mostly on women because, while yes, this is a massive change for men and the shape of their adulthoods and the expectations for how life is going to go for them. Historically, it has always – the idea of independent men in the world has always been better supported by society and in our imagination. Men have always been able to have their own economic independence, to earn on their own, to have really an independent sex life that wasn't – you know, there's not the risk in part because of the way that reproduction works. Men could always have a more liberated sex life outside of or in advance of marriage than women were able to. Men have been regarded as independent full adults. In fact, white men have been regarded as the independent full adults and American citizens since our founding in ways that people of color and women have not been. So it's not – while it profoundly changes the course of adulthood for men in ways that I think are fascinating, and I do hope that people write books about the male perspective on this, it's not the kind of revolutionary rupture that it is for women to suddenly have this massive population of women that is saying, wait, we are the full adults in the United States. We are living independently.
And you write, the independence of women is a crucial tool – in their long struggle toward a more just and equitable position in the world. Interesting feedback and lots of it for you. Gretchen is writing to us. She says, Rebecca, I'm an unmarried 28-year-old woman who's been in a monogamous committed relationship with my partner for 9 years. I have a lot of friends who've also been in long relationships before getting married or who remain unmarried. She asks, how single are the single ladies you're writing about? Are we really living independently in significant ways, or are we just choosing not to make a formal commitment?
Well, one of the distinctions that I try to make clear I'm not making in the book is simply between married as one existence and unmarried as another existence. Mm-hmm. It's not just two categories. Mostly what I'm writing about is when you lift the very constrictive and historical model of marriage kicks off female adulthood, you're sort of everybody's hustled into this hetero early married pattern, and that is what defines American adulthood, especially for women. When you remove that constrictive timeline, what you get is a huge variety of possibilities. Mm-hmm. And so you get all kinds of there is a rise in cohabitation, long-term relationships, in many cases either perhaps one long-term monogamous relationship with cohabitation or not cohabitation that lasts for decades or for your whole life that might as well be a marriage but is not legalized. In many cases, it's kind of serial monogamy. I'm sure we all have either lived this or have friends who have, you know, where you're in and out of a series of committed relationships. For some people, it's a kind of sexual variety, taking a lot of partners, people who enjoy that kind of sex life. For some people, it's periods or a lifetime of celibacy. For some people, there is late marriage. There's an early marriage that ends for one reason or another. There can be a late marriage. There can be a divorce. There can be children had within marriage or without. But mostly, it's people living all these different things in sequence, right? Their own sequence, depending on the events that they encounter, the people that they encounter, their own tastes, desires, impulses, predilections. And that is all those choices and that variety of paths is now much more available. So it's not as though I'm simply saying, oh, there's single life that's unmarried life that is one way versus married life that was another. It's mostly that if you remove the imperative for early hetero marriage, what you get is women able to combine a whole bunch of different things in their lives in different patterns depending on their circumstances and their desires. And that is the liberation.
And as you write, altering the scope of possibility for over half the country's population. Tara's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Tara, you're on the air with Rebecca Traister.
Hi, Rebecca. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I actually am so excited that you're on the air because I am very much deliberately making a decision to not enter a relationship right now so that I can actually be free to go to law school anywhere in the country. Mm-hmm. I realized when I got out of my last relationship that the emotional burden from a breakup was just too much, that I couldn't go through it at the same time that I was trying to pursue my own interests. So I am deliberately not dating. I do engage in different kinds of relationships, but that's definitely not going to become a monogamous situation.
How old are you, Tara, if I may ask?
I'm 23.
So how are you thinking now about the next decade or more? I mean, law school you want to hold in a free space, but how are you thinking about the longer path ahead?
So the longer path ahead, I don't see myself having children until mid-30s. I really value my career. I value my intelligence, and that's always been paramount to me. I saw my mom struggle through a super painful divorce, and I don't know. That's actually a pretty common thing amongst people my age, where I don't want to be trapped in something I don't really necessarily want. It's not super important to me. So.
And do you feel any social stigma from this, Tara, or does it feel like, hey, make your choice, do what you will, it's A-okay?
I would say it's a mixed bag. I mean, certainly at family gatherings, it's always like, oh, are you dating anyone? And I can kind of shove people off pretty quickly by saying, you know, it's just not, like, it's not right. I'm too busy. I'm studying for the LSAT, and nobody's really too worried about that. But, I mean, it definitely in social situations, I start to feel it. So I was just at a potluck last week, and everyone was coupled up, and I kind of just sat there and reaffirmed my decision, and I was like, well, you know, in a week, you're not going to want to be in a relationship. You're just feeling a little bit blue right now. Right,
so hang in there, hang tough, Tara. I really appreciate your call, Rebecca Traister. What do you hear in this story?
I hear something that was so typical of so many of the people I talked to for this book. So I interviewed 100 women, about 100 women around the country, you know, in different positions, different economic brackets, different races, ethnicities, religions, different ages, and different marital status, right? Mm-hmm. But so many of the young women coming out of college expressed some version of what Tara just did, which is they have – so one of the fascinating things about how marriage still works for women, even though it is changing as an institution, is that there are still economic and professional tolls that marriage and childbearing take. There are all kinds of contemporary studies that tell us that women still lose ground professionally and often lose salary, lose earnings when they – both when they marry and then when they have children. And even women who may not be consciously politicized around this sort of understand it instinctively. And so one of the things – this is not a politicized movement. Most women who are not marrying are not saying, I'm not marrying because I don't believe in marriage or because I want a more liberated life. That's not at all what's happening. It's a behavioral – a mass behavioral change that is not politicized. However, lots of women coming out of schools who I spoke to me in exactly these terms that Tara just used. I need to establish my professional economic base, and I do not want to be – I don't want to have that base damaged in any way by the competitive pulls of an emotional relationship. Some college kids said, I need to study. I can't – I have to do my work. I can't be distracted by a relationship. Other people talked about it as Tara did. I want to be able to move where I need to move and not have to weigh the demands of another person. And so that is one of and that's the sort of most – it's not politicized exactly. It's about pursuing personal desire, goal, ambitions, which was really not possible for women to do and to conceive of as being a normalized, socially acceptable choice until really quite recently in our history. And that's really illustrative of what's so remarkable about what we're hearing from so many of these young women.
Monica is calling. Hi, Monica. You're on the air with Rebecca Traister.
Hi, Rebecca. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to say I think that, Rebecca, your message about empowering women and single women, I think that is fantastic. But I'm a little concerned only because I feel like the backlash to that is the single woman is hurting the family structure. A single woman that has children has the highest rate of poverty. They have the highest rate of mental illness. They're not educated. These are the women that we see living in hotels, and they're not doing well. What do you think about that?
I write a lot about this in the book because this has been the rhetoric around single motherhood for a long time, really since the middle of the 20th century when white middle-class women were being hustled into a kind of suburban domesticity through a lot of government intervention and the development of housing that was exclusively white, and the same sort of policies were cutting off black families from a lot of those economic resources and creating an exacerbating a racial divide in terms of what resources were available to build nuclear family life on. And black marriage rates began to fall at that point in the 50s. And you see the first sign of the connection between blaming single motherhood for poverty in the Moynihan Report in 1965. And that was then taken up by conservatives, and you see it through Ronald Reagan's use of the welfare queen. You see it even into some of the rhetoric around welfare reform in the 1990s, and you hear it all the time. I mean, that was as Mitt Romney talks about that not in the clip that you played, Tom, but in the 2012 election, asked, what are we going to do to stem the tide of gun violence? Mitt Romney. Really, his response was, people should marry someone. This is, the Bush administration's marriage education programs into which they have poured billions of dollars. The conservative rhetoric around this is that the cure for poverty is marriage. It's actually the reverse. Poverty and economic inequality makes marriage inherently unstable. And so in the book, I argue a lot about how it is actually the reverse, that if we made more women economically stable, more women and men economically stable, you would see a positive effect on marriage.
Put the economics first, but you hear the sincere question from Monica about how does all this work? And you're right, there's a range, big range of circumstances, economic and otherwise, depending where you fall on the ladder of American incomes, married or not married. Rebecca Traister's new book, wonderful new book, is All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women and the Rise of an Independent Nation. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
We get bored, so we get mad.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's exploding number of single women, their lives, their impact in the workplace and society, their power. Rebecca Traister is my guest. She's author of the new book, All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women and the Rise of an Independent Nation. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Is being a single woman now an identity, a holding pattern, a little of both? Does it mean liberation to you or something else? Can you see the impact of more single women in the workplace stepping up, taking charge, climbing? And single women, where do you draw your social support? Is it abundant? Is it enough? Is the world adjusting to you, your numbers, your needs? A couple of years back, Piers Morgan asked Oprah Winfrey to clarify why she and her boyfriend Stedman Graham never got married.
That is such an old story, Piers. I'm not getting married. I'm not the married.
Period.
I'm just not the marrying kind.
But she's Oprah. Is there still stigma out there? Maybe. TV series Gilmore Girls, Lorelai Gilmore, played by Lauren Graham, single mom in her late 30s. Here's a scene from the sixth season. Lane, a friend of her daughter, Lorelai's daughter, is about to get married. And Lane's mother, Mrs. Kim, played by Emily Kuroda, says she cannot come if she doesn't have a date.
You mean you're coming alone, unescorted?
Well, Rory will be there, so.
No, she won't like it.
Who won't?
You can't come alone. An unmarried woman of a certain age, unescorted, wearing the clothes you tend to wear. People will think things, bad things.
Like what?
Like you're a tramp and possibly for sale.
Oh, boy, Gilmore Girls. Rebecca Traister's stigma. Is it all in the rearview mirror? Is it still out there?
Oh, no, it's still out there. And you know, and in fact, it's increased. There's backlash. So that as marriage rates have fallen and marriage ages have risen and marriage has become less the norm and you see more women living in independent ways, whether through economic advancement or having babies on their own, you see a cultural backlash to it. That's the rise of the wedding industrial complex, the fetishization of marriage, the say yes to the dress, you know, idea of marriage that I think puts a lot of pressure on people, the social networking, you know, engagement ring shots, like the people feel this in all kinds of ways. It's interesting, the clip you play of Oprah, one of the populations most directly targeted by this pressure is black women whose marriage ages tend to be later and are just targeted in pop culture unapologetically as, you know, written about all the time as though they're never going to get married. You know, you have Steve Harvey sort of giving lessons on how women can find mates better, how black women should, you know, should be sort of more submissive and less independent. And, you know, Tyrese at one point said, you're independenting your way to loneliness, black women. You know, there are a lot of unforgiving messages being sent to single women, including by politicians like Mitt Romney. And Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush, who said that, you know, the problem is that we don't shame single mothers enough. He wrote that in 1994 and he's reiterated again recently. So not only has the stigma not disappeared, it is intensified in other kinds of ways. But on the other hand, it hasn't stopped the behavior, so that women still aren't marrying despite the sort of messages that are being sent to them. And simply by continuing not to marry, they increasingly affirm independent life outside of marriage, as a norm and as a possibility for women, which I think slowly over time, even though the messages that you're getting and the punishing stuff that people are saying to you may be painful, it also increases the feeling that you're not alone.
Let's go to that. Michelle in West Hartford, Connecticut. You're on with Rebecca Traister. Thank you for calling, Michelle.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. I think there's also another point. You know, I spent 30 years working in hospitality, which is an industry not conducive to family life. And so I'm not married, but not by choice.
Okay.
And then for single women, when you hit 30 or 35, the men in your circle are not interested in you because they feel like they're ready to settle down and have families. And you're going to have fertility issues. So they're looking for younger women. And so it does leave this hole. I'm now 57. I adopted my son through a foster care system.
Okay.
And now at 57, I have a 13-year-old. And really nobody wants to know who I am. So it's very difficult, even for those of us who do want to marry. The guys aren't out there.
What do you mean nobody wants to know who you are? Do you feel social acceptance, Michelle, at this point or not?
Midlife mothers, you know, like myself, who became parents over the age of 40, were sort of looked on as pariahs. Most of my friends, and I have a fabulous support group, but most of my friends are other single women or single moms like myself, also 40s, 50s. who sort of feel outside the social norm, because people do look at us like we've made this choice, you know, to not be in coupledom, and or something's wrong with us because we're not married, you know.
Yeah, yeah, and whether you've chosen it or not, and of course they don't necessarily know. Rebecca, the numbers may be growing, but there's no giant embrace that Michelle's feeling there.
Right. Well, I think that speaks a bit to what I was just saying about the remaining stigmas and the fact that we don't have yet a lot of supports in place. But there's something else I want to talk about, the notion of choice, which, you know, that we're choosing not to get married.
She's saying she didn't.
Vast, what?
Michelle said she did not choose.
Right.
To
no,
be
that's what again. That's what I want to speak mm-hmm. to. Is because I do think that that's, you know, part of the language that I'm using around the book and that people are using around the book. But in fact, for so many single women out there, and certainly the ones that I interviewed, it's not a matter of choice. It's, as I said, mm-hmm. there are those few who are saying, yes, I'm delaying it because I want to do something else first. But so many more are saying, I didn't meet the right person, or I did meet the right person, but he or she didn't want to marry me. It just didn't happen for me. The men weren't out there. There weren't the mates available. And so it feels, it's not a choice. It's not like, oh, I elected not to do this. It's just that circumstances conspired to leave me. And many women in the book speak about feeling tremendous regret. Circumstances conspired to leave me without this thing that I wanted, that I still want, that I thought I'd have. And that is certainly chronicled in the book too. The point I would make about that is that, the choice is not so much an active one, but it's the ability still to have other kinds of life, you know, to parent a son over 40, to adopt and become a single woman, to have, even though, you know, there may not be the feeling of social support, what she described as a fabulous support group of people who are there for her, to have a career in the hospitality industry. I'm not saying that that in any way erases the other disappointments and sadness and regret about not having found a person if you wanted to find that person. But you can now live even if you haven't found that person and have a full and multifaceted life as a parent, as a friend, as an earner, as a professional. And that's another aspect of what we're looking at here. It's not always active choosing, but there are other possibilities for other avenues in life.
Go to Barbara in New York. Barbara, thank you for calling. You're on with Rebecca.
Oh, hi. Thank you. I'm a 58-year-old white middle-class cis woman who just, you know, 40 years ago decided marriage is kind of pointless. I didn't really see the reason for it. When I was really little, in the early 60s, marriage was held up as a man will take care of you for the rest of your life as long as you do your bit, the household, etc. And then I started seeing all these divorces, and it just seemed like a big lie, and I didn't see the point of it. And then as an adult, when I was in long-term relationships, I've had two, one of 10 years, one of 14 years, I still didn't see the point. And then I also felt I didn't need either religious or government affirmation of my relationship. So I, you know, have never been married, even though I am a mother, and it's been fantastic. I was lucky because I went to law school and I could make enough money to support my child and myself. But I've had no problems with it, which maybe is partly from living in New York. I don't really know why else. I haven't had any trouble. It's been great.
Just worked for you, and you've got that degree behind you to help sail you through that. I mean, Rebecca, I guess it depends a lot, and you write about this, on economic circumstances, sometimes on the culture of the particular area or part of the country you're living in, or circumstances in which you're living.
Yes, I have a whole chapter in my book about the relationship between cities and single life, and how cities, for a long time throughout United States history. And I was doing reading about early modern Europe where, you know, single women flocked to cities or to towns. And cities have always supported single female life in a way that rural communities and suburban communities haven't. And you can still see that playing out in that in cities, marriage ages are higher and marriage rates lower than they are in suburban and rural places across the United States, which is one of the reasons you have so many different experiences of singlehood. Being a single 35-year-old woman in New York City may be an absolute norm, but it's not necessarily a norm in a rural part of Kentucky. Although, actually, increasingly it is. It is true that marriage ages are rising all over the country. And cities support single women in very particular ways. They offer kind of infrastructures of community, people living nearby, there are jobs, there's public transportation. And I think that's part of that, that in fact, it's true. Being in New York does to great lengths to help single life for women.
Allie writes to us, Rebecca, she says, I'm a 33-year-old single female teacher by choice, single. My lifestyle completely baffles my colleagues, she says. As a single woman, I've completed my master's degree, bought a home all of my own. However, none of these accomplishments were validated by the school. We have a Sunshine Fund, which celebrates life accomplishments or moments at school. However, the only life accomplishments that are validated are getting married or having a baby. Well, you know, what about in that way? That's just, that's the culture of one workplace. Or more broadly, the way we put public policy together, whether, you know, there's a lot of talk about what about reproductive rights and about children. Does our society, our workplaces, do our politics line up around this new reality you describe?
They have to start lining up around it, and that's exactly right. You know, the protection, the further protection of reproductive rights, which are being eroded all over the country, this is very much an issue that's going to be up for grabs because we're likely to have even more Supreme Court seats open than we do now, you know, in the next presidential administration, and that's going to determine reproductive rights, voting rights. You know, single women in 2012 made up almost a quarter of the electorate, 23% of the electorate, and they vote very Democratic for a lot of these reasons, that the Democratic platform is far more likely to support kind of social policies that, based on this Democratic primary, are moving sort of closer to a Nordic model than we've ever had before. And that's absolutely necessary to support single women. I think the workplace culture is another thing we need to adjust. I write a lot in the book about the public policy fixes we need, everything from paid leave to subsidized daycare to higher minimum wage. But there's also sort of attitude adjustment so that, you know, we are now very used to saying to women who are getting married and taking a honeymoon and even though we don't have mandated paid leave, there's at least a social acceptance. Oh, you've had a baby. Maybe you're going to stay home. You need time. You need rest. You need to get home. You need to leave at 5 to have dinner with your in-laws or leave at 5 to go pick up the kids. And we don't, you know, we absolutely need to adjust our attitudes and our view of women who don't either have partners at home or in-laws or kids to pick up and yet have full lives and responsibilities and commitments that they need to attend to and cannot simply fill in the blanks for those women who are more traditional family structures. And that's one thing that I think workplaces across the country, and I heard from so many women in my book saying, look, I have worked through people's maternity leaves, through their honeymoons. I'm the one who stays late at the office because they have to get home to their kids. And there's not a lot of acknowledgement that I have people I need to get to, too, including myself, and take care of myself and my friends, my parents, my siblings, you know, be a part of the organizations I'm a part of, have my commitments. And we need, again, we are still coming off of hundreds of years in which the female worth was really weighed on a scale that particularly measured wifeliness and maternity. And we need to acknowledge that there are all kinds of things that fill women's adult lives, and they require all kinds of time and energy, and that we need to support that.
What about relations between the genders, whether within marriage ultimately, perhaps after a long period of being single, or not? How do you see the fact of this much longer, deeper period of single life for many American women changing relations between men and women?
Well, there's some evidence that it's making marriage a better institution, a stronger institution. I mean, you can see pretty direct correlations between the states in the United States that have the highest marriage ages and the lowest rates of divorce. So there seems to be increasing evidence that marrying later may put you in a better position to have a stronger or more lasting marriage. You know, I spoke before about how the development of skills is if you're growing into adults as independent people without either somebody to rely on as an earner or somebody to rely on as a domestic helpmeet, you're developing those sets of skills individually. And when you partner, there may be a more equitable distribution of them so that you don't get just one person making money and one person doing the childcare or one person doing the housework by dint of gender alone. And that may make for more equitable marriages. You know, I think that the advent of gay marriage, ironically, it seems like that's and many people have argued it's a move, a reinscription of a traditional institution on people who used to live outside of that institution. But actually, it's breaking up and sort of part of the dismantlement of marriage as an organization of hetero power in which men had certain kinds of power and women really didn't have a lot of power. And gay marriage is contributing to the scrambling of what marriage means. So I actually think that the advent of increased single life for women and for men, ironically, is improving marriage as an institution.
You just got a few seconds. Do you miss single life, or do you feel like you've brought those strengths into your married life, Rebecca?
I feel like I've brought the strengths into my married life. I miss the primacy of my friends.
Yeah, a different...
I love my friends. They are still my friends. I'm very close to them. But, you know, there was a degree to which they were my spouses. They were my family. And that has changed.
Nurtured over time, time of single living. Rebecca Traister's terrific new book is All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women, and the Rise of an Independent Nation. Rebecca, this has been great. We're very grateful to you for joining us. Thanks. Good luck with the book. And thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.
We'll go out with a little more Beyonce, Grown Woman. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm